from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. First, a bit of housekeeping. You might have heard toward the top of the hour some comments about abstinence-only education. And that program aired a week ago on this show. You can hear that conversation in full, as you can listen to all conversations that are podcasted every hour of Connections, wxxinews.org/connections, if you happen to miss any of the programs, or you can scroll through and see what we have been up to. Also, there are some questions about whether we're going to hear the president, and that is 1 hour from now. So at 1 p.m., we're going to hear President Obama talking about the Iran deal. We will carry that live. But our connection this hour was made in 2005, when comedian Bill Cosby was giving a deposition, and the Associated Press uncovered documents of that deposition just last month, with a judge deciding that it could be made public. In that deposition, Cosby admits that he gave a woman the sedative Quaaludes for the purpose of getting her to have sex with him. Cosby's lawyers had asked that the documents remain sealed on the grounds that the information would embarrass Bill Cosby. He has refused to talk about the dozens of sexual assault allegations against him in the past. But this time, his own words in court confirmed that at least one of the allegations was true. He drugged a woman, and the dozens of other allegations are certainly similar in nature. And so that brings us to a question. Why is it that so many people refuse to believe nearly 40 women who told essentially the same story of sexual assault? What can we learn from this sad story? After all, when more women chose to come forward, Bill Cosby's longtime co-star, Felicia Rashad, accused them of orchestrating a stunt to destroy Cosby's legacy. And she added that Bill Cosby's legacy is important to the culture of America, so why let it be tarnished? My guests for the hour include Anna Potter, Director of Programs and Services at Bavona. Nice to have you in studio, Anna.
Thank you.
Also here is Dee Krebs, who is a family nurse practitioner at the URMC Emergency Department, and she's the director of the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program there. Dee, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Also here is Pete Navratil. He's the co-owner of Tree of Hope Counseling, co-founder of Stand Up Guys, which is a program of Resolve of Greater Rochester. Nice to have you here, Pete.
Thank you.
And Allison O'Malley is the Executive Director of Resolve of Greater Rochester. Nice to have you here, Allison.
Thank you.
Well, Anna Potter, right before the program began, you said, unfortunately, this was not a surprise, and this was a man who cultivated a persona that he leveraged for years, didn't he?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that you need to consider in sexual assault always, people rarely want to believe the victim. I think that a lot of that is people don't want to believe that it happens ever. So not believing victims is not new. It's in forever, I would say. But I think in this situation, you have to look at Bill Cosby and how the power and control that he really had over the community, the general public, society in general. He was the Jell-O man. He had such a pure persona that I don't think we want to believe it. So it makes it that much more difficult for victims to come forward. You don't ever know the absolute truth of what happened. But, you know, having been in the field for so many years, my question is, why do we first say they're not telling the truth? They're liars. Why do we jump there? I want to believe victims. I want to believe that people are telling the truth. But with sexual assault, we just very, very quickly jump on the victim.
Dee, what do you make of it?
Oh, I totally agree with what Anna said. I've been in the field for about 16 years now. And the general public, you always jump to, it didn't really happen. And yes, I totally agree with what she said.
Pete?
Yeah, I totally agree with what Anna's talking about. We have a blame the victim mentality. And I think for the most part, when it comes to violence against women, we think of this not as a man's issue. We think of it as a woman's issue. And I think part of this is it's around the fact that there is really no naturally occurring forms of accountability for men that perpetrate this type of violence until a victim comes forward and says something happened. It really didn't happen. And just because she said so, we don't want to believe it. So, and then we disregard it, I think, to some extent, because we have historically somewhat discounted the voices of women in the first place. So you have all these factors that go into play. And I think the reason that he can get away with this, or why he was able to get away with it, is the simple answer to that is because he can. There's really no measure of accountability that exists. So these women come forward, and then we begin to blame them. You know, reading some of the scripts or comments, you know, a lot of people are believing that this is some kind of a conspiracy, or that people are looking for quick money. There's some other reason other than the fact that, in fact, what we see today is pretty good evidence that Bill Cosby's a serial rapist.
Allison O'Malley?
Yeah. The challenge in victim blaming, it's just so prevalent in our culture. It really doesn't matter what type of crime. When there's a violent crime committed against someone, the question is, why were they there in the first place, or what did they do to deserve it? When a woman is raped, it's, what did she do to set herself up for that experience? Was she dressed a certain way? Did she look a certain way? And I think as human beings, we need to deflect our concerns and our fears about these kinds of crimes happening to us as to separate ourselves from other people. It doesn't make it right. And it really, cases like this, I appreciate your wanting to explore this from a what can we learn perspective, because I think we need to learn to listen to the voices of victims and make it safer for people to come forward. It doesn't matter whether it's sexual assault or it's domestic violence, particularly when you're dealing with people of privilege and, you know, people who are employed. We like to think that this only happens to people who are poor, and it doesn't. And it certainly happens to poor people, too. But no one is immune to these crimes. And that is what's so frightening about it. It really scares people. And I think that's part of why we go to a place of victim blaming.
Well, if I could just jump in.
Please
do. One of the things with victim blaming, where it stems from typically is a false sense of security. So
right.
What people want to say is that if I don't do what a victim did, then I'm gonna keep myself safe. So we become judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
So then we all say the crime happens with a specific geographic neighborhood.
Correct.
In the city, or it certainly doesn't happen in a suburb, or an age group. In my years, people would say that sexual assault happens in the 20-year-olds, teens, and you go to the emergency room with D and have an evidence kit for a 75-year-old, and you
mm-hmm.
quickly learn that there are no boundaries.
That's
in the
right.
sexual assault world.
If you want to call the program, listeners, we'd like to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Don't worry, Allison. That's happened to me many times before in this studio. And I will also say that we've had a number of emails and comments online. I'm going to be reading some of those as we go throughout the hour, because there have been a number of comments from various angles on this issue. But when Allison talks about focusing on what can we do better, what can we learn, let me start with something you just referenced, which is that there is this quick move to always say, but what were you wearing?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'm assuming that you've all now mm-hmm. seen the meme, mm-hmm. The but what were you wearing meme. And audience, if you haven't seen some of these posts, some of the really powerful words that women are writing about their own sexual assault, read them. They're showing you what they were wearing, and some of the most powerful images I've seen are women saying, please stop asking, but what were you wearing? And this is what I was wearing, and it wasn't revealing, or maybe you think it was. Why is that relevant? What would you say to that, Allison?
Yeah, I think, again, we want to support, but we need to change the thinking that says that domestic violence and sexual assault only happen from a stranger to a person. The vast majority of these crimes happen in a familial relationship. So it really doesn't matter what a person is wearing. Most of the time, there is a knowledge and a knowing of the person who's offending
sure.
against them. So again, people like to think of these crimes as only stranger-related types of incidents. But most of the time, you are dealing with, this is somebody that you know. And in the case with Bill Cosby, these were women who had begun to develop some sort of rapport with him. This wasn't like he walked out on the street and grabbed them and dragged them in and drugged them. So I think that's really important. And the other thing that's also important is
you know, there's a lot of discussion about date rape, drugs, and people being drugged. And this case is also bringing that to light. The number one rape drug is alcohol. So we don't need to be adding Quaaludes or other drugs in order to get somebody drunk. A rape is going to happen when a rapist is present. That's the scary thought. And what allows certain people to believe that they can take what they want when they want it.
But Pete, here we are. That question comes up all the time. Well, what was she wearing, though? You know, and I think I'm glad to see this movement to try to obliterate that question entirely.
I think it becomes the interesting thing about blame the victim is it takes the focus off the offender. So we talk about victims in terms of being women, but we don't talk about offenders in terms of being men. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens is it's about the character of men. It's not what she's wearing. It's about what he's thinking or what he's entitled to because he has some belief in him. And I use he because we don't even reflect the fact that 99% of offenders are male. So when we talk about sexual assault, we're talking about primarily a male issue. Women are victims, but men are the perpetrators. And when we think about the character of men, we think about not what she was wearing, it's what he was thinking. And she should be able to wear whatever he wants. It's not what she's doing, it's about what he's doing. And I think that sometimes these conversations really take us off that mark. So you don't say, what's going on in the minds of men that think, as Bill Cosby did, that women were sexual objects, that is, if he had a desire to have a sexual relations with a woman who was unconscious or drugged, I don't know what that all means, but what's going on in his head? And what is it about our culture that can actually kind of like not even go there and talk about that? This is about the character of men, not about what she's wearing.
And so let's talk about what we should say if this uncomfortable and unfortunate circumstance comes before any of us. Dee and Anna, I want to hear from you on this. And Anna, I'll start with you because you said earlier that, you know, you don't want to tell somebody, I don't believe you, or, you know, no, that could have. But what do you say when someone makes the choice to open up about this? What can you say?
I want to backtrack just for 1 second because I think the what you were wearing question, I believe that that's a very basic question that people believe that when she's wearing something provocative, that equals consent. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry that I backtracked on you.
No, that's okay.
But really, they're asking that question because they believe that just by virtue of what she was wearing gave the offender consent to go ahead, to move forward. So if we say, look what she was wearing, aha, she gave him consent. Consent comes from your mind and your words. It does not come from the clothes that you're wearing. I'm sorry.
No, so
I just want to, part and parcel with the whole
was she asking for it,
which is about the
worst thing you can even think.
Correct. I also just want to throw in there, like, why were you there? Why were you there by yourself? Or why were you there? Like, it doesn't matter. I was there because I wanted a drink.
Right.
Or whatever the reason was.
Yes. So
it shouldn't be questioned, you know?
I guess the logical extension to, well, what was she wearing to, well, was she drinking?
You know? Right. Exactly.
Oh, well, as if.
They gave consent.
Yeah, right. As if women should not be allowed to drink unless they want to put themselves in that position, and then it's their own fault. I mean, it really is it's a kind of logic that it's amazing, but people, you hear this all the time, don't you? I mean, don't you hear that, Dee?
Oh, all the time, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, we do. And so instead of saying those kind of things,
yes,
if someone is going to open up about it, what can we do? What can we
say? So really, if someone takes the courage to disclose to someone, the first thing that you say is, I'm so sorry that this has happened, and I believe you. Mm-hmm. It's rape victims do not tell. I mean, the false reports are just like any other crime. That's the way the numbers have always been. You know, maybe 2-3%. But for someone to take the courage, you know, we've already accomplished that it's a very victim-blaming society. We don't believe the victims. So for someone to come forward, and I will tell you that in my experience, the stranger assaults, they're believed very easily. So it's the acquaintance. It's those the more intimate situations that they get into that they know that they will be judged. So if someone discloses to you, really it's thank you for telling me. What can I do to help? Mm-hmm. I believe you. You know, what have you done? And there's always options to move forward. You know, Deacon talked about the medical options. There's STDs consideration, legal options, counseling. You know, there's a lot of support around it, but really just stopping to say, thank you for telling me and how can I help? Right. It's very basic.
And many people will wait quite a long time before they come forward, which makes some of the medical options not viable any longer, but it doesn't mean that they don't deserve to be believed and supported and heard.
And I just want to say that more than 80% of our patients that do present as sexual assault victims are assaulted by someone they know. And that's statistically across the country, correct? And the thing is, when you're sexually assaulted by a stranger, you find comfort with your friends. But when you're sexually assaulted by someone you know, all of a sudden you're afraid to go out with your friends because you don't trust them anymore. So the psychological damage is just so totally different than being sexually assaulted by a stranger.
We're talking about lessons from the Bill Cosby story, the scandal, and unfortunately this sad story that has unfolded in recent weeks and really that's been going on for years. Lessons we can take from that. And we had a phone call from someone off air who wants to say that we should stop talking about clothing because men can be raped too. I mean, I would never say that men can't be raped. Mm-hmm. But again, Pete, you mentioned that it really, it's not that it's impossible, but we are focusing on sort of one side of the story, and it's the larger side of the story, Pete?
It's the way larger side of the story. The other side of the story of men can be raped is that men rape the majority of men who are raped. So again, we throw out this as a deflection off of this. The fact that women can rape men is it's possible, but it's so minuscule. We don't have a lot of men anywhere coming forward talking about having been raped by their female partner. That's not to say that it doesn't happen, but it's just something that's very, very, very uncommon. And so oftentimes this is another deflection kind of off of the reality of this. Men rape men and women. And that, again, is one of these things that's, you know, that's part of that story that we don't really get a good handle on this.
You're hearing from Pete Navratil, who's the co-owner of Tree of Hope Counseling and the co-founder of Stand Up Guys, which is a program of Resolve of Greater Rochester. What is Stand Up Guys, Pete?
Well, just Stand Up Guys is a group we formed a little over 10 years ago, and it's really about just raising the voices of men and getting men engaged in having a conversation about why men are violent against women, and also what can men do about it. And one of the things that we predicate our belief system is that the majority of men in our culture are good guys. They're stand-up guys. They care deeply about the women in their lives, and they care about these issues. It just becomes hard for a guy to stand up and speak out about it. There's a lot of issues that keep men silent. And even though we know men are good guys, they don't talk about it. And again, even in the media, we deflect off of this as not having meaningful conversations of men speaking to other men. So part of our mission is to talk to other men and also talk to boys about character matters, about leading a life that has meaning and purpose, that involves care and compassion for others, and that it's not just about winning every game, or, you know, we were talking about women and men before. You know, for guys to have sexual conquests is a sign of manhood in our culture. We don't look at that as a negative thing. And rarely do guys get pictures posted on the internet by their girlfriends as a way of outing or disgracing their boyfriends or their ex-lovers, which we're seeing now. What we're seeing is men doing that to women. Why is that? And so, you know, raises this issue again about where's men's role in this, and how do men speak to other men in a meaningful way that says, in my view, I call it character matters. You know, who you are, what your beliefs are, and how you express yourself towards everyone that you live with, including the women in your lives, is very important.
It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and this is Carol in Chilai. Go ahead, Carol.
Hello. Just something I wanted to add to the conversation, because I don't think it's been touched on. The phenomenon of groupies, they are there for every star of every imaginable place. And this, I am a child of the 60s, and it's, there have been movies about it. And if you go to a concert, you see them lined up. It's not just women. It's men, too. But I just want to say that there are women. I guess when I first heard the news about Mr. Cosby, I really thought, well, he made some bad decisions about some groupies that were throwing themselves at him. And now the numbers are such that you really wonder if that could be possible. But I just know that it happens. As the mother of a young son, I worry about, you know, if a female decided to, you know, put her mark on my son or a child of someone I know, I just would be very, very upset if he was just so gullible and just thought, well, nothing's going to happen. This will just be a one-night stand. And I have another question about Quaaludes. As I recall from the 60s and 70s, I didn't do them, I hasten to add, but I can remember people, like both parties, taking them, talking about it, and saying that it just enhanced the experience. Could that have been going on, or what on earth would he want with someone who was out cold? I don't understand that whole aspect of it.
Carol, thank you for the phone call. Let's start with, I guess we'll start with Quaaludes. Allison?
I want to address two things that Carol said. So in the idea of the groupies, you know, I do believe that somebody like a Bill Cosby really could pick anyone, really, at the end of the day. So that's part of his position and part of using the power control that Anna alluded to earlier. But I think you have to peel that back and look at the other information that's come forward about how predatory he really was in his behavior. His stage manager or somebody who was very close to him who managed his affairs was the person who was responsible for acquiring the drugs, making sure that the drugs were available to Bill when he was ready to have them administered to the person who was his, who he had targeted. So at this point, he's now the target. He's establishing the target. He's no longer the one that somebody's looking to, you know, I want a piece of that, to be very vulgar, but that's really kind of what we're alluding to here. So I think it's very, very important to look honestly at what we've learned about his behavior. He was very, very predatory in how he went about doing this.
And can I also add, we had a caller off air who is angry at the very nature of this program today. Mm-hmm. She said she didn't think anyone is guilty until they are proven so by a jury. Can't believe a show that claims to be high quality like Connections would bring people to talk about Bill Cosby as though he's been proven guilty of anything. Anna, what do you think?
So what about the victims? So again,
well this person is apparently saying you have no proof that anyone has been victimized. Well, I guess now we have Bill Cosby at least once in a deposition saying, yes, I bought Quaaludes for the purpose of giving them to women for sex.
Correct.
But so there, that is one.
Yes.
And I will say, first, let me just answer as the host of the program, and then I'm going to kick it to the panel on this. I appreciate the question of being careful to consider evidence. I do. I also look at sexual assault, and I trust the experts who tell me that 2%, maybe 2 to 5% are false allegations. Mm-hmm. And I take that very seriously. Mm-hmm. You don't want anyone's life being ruined by it.
Mm-hmm. No.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. What you have in the case of Bill Cosby is dozens of women telling essentially the same story. They're not getting, I don't understand the notion that people thinking women get rich off this. There's something to gain, as if there's some sort of currency in being a sexual assault victim. That is a bizarre narrative. I've never understood that. And now that Bill Cosby is at least in court, in which he tried to suppress those documents being released to the public, admitted to drugging women for sex, that is sexual assault. That's one admission. And yes, I believe the victims. I'm not afraid to say it.
Right.
So I apologize to the caller's idea of what a disappointment this sounds like, but I am saying I believe these women, mm-hmm. Period. I don't know if all 40 are telling exactly a perfect version of truth, but I believe them. And so, yes, I've considered all of what I've seen. And based on what I've seen, I believe it. So what would you say, Anna Pollard?
Sexual assault is a crime that happens normally behind closed doors. So if you think about some of the other crimes, you know, obviously murder being horrible, but someone breaks into your house, the evidence that comes with other crimes, sexual assault is a lot of times, because remember what Dee just said, it usually goes upwards of 80% that it is someone that they know, maybe love and trust. So when you look at the crime that's being committed behind a closed door, it most often comes down to he said, she said. So in, you know, the whole time we've been talking here, we're very victim blaming. You know, and we just talked about the groupies that, I mean, let's face it, we don't want this to be true. This was an icon, you know, in the Black community, in the comedic community. I mean, this man was an icon. I mean, he still is for a lot of reasons. We don't want it to be true. But in my world, when I'm talking about victims, why would they come forward? You know, why would, because right now, they're not getting a lot of money out of it. They're getting ridiculed. They're getting judged. And they're being questioned on their integrity for being a victim of, potentially, being a victim of a crime. So for other crimes, if you think about, you know, I always used to use the jaywalking. You know, someone jaywalking is against the law, and they're running across the street, and it doesn't give the right to hit them. You know, are we going to question the jaywalker, or are we going to question the driver?
Yeah,
probably the driver.
Well, consider the words of Jewel Allison, who is one of Bill Cosby's alleged victims, and here's what she said about why she considered not telling her story. Here's the quote to the Washington Post. This is Jewel Allison. Quote, his accusers, mostly white so far, have faced retaliation, humiliation, and skepticism by coming forward. As an African-American woman, I felt the stakes for me were even higher. Historic images of Black men being vilified en masse as sexually violent sent chills through my body. Telling my story wouldn't only help bring down Cosby, I feared it would undermine the entire African-American community, end quote. That's Jewel Allison, who did eventually tell her story. And so, again, this notion that there's something to gain. Think of all of the turmoil that you've already gone through as a victim, assuming the allegations are true, as a victim, and then to have to be questioned, be ridiculed, you know, all of the things that you're hearing. That's why, to the woman who called and wanted to know why we're doing this program today, I think we do need to talk about this more.
It's awareness. Do you know, and I want to point out, too, I believe, as I was reading through some of the victims' stories, there were a couple few that were minors. So, you know, and for us at Bavona, you know, I mean, that's statutory. So, I mean, that brings up so many other different aspects to the perpetration, if you will. So it's, I mean, there's the male, female, the adults, the consenting. A few of them were minors. They weren't even able to consent just by virtue of their age.
Yeah. Do you want to add something?
Well,
there, Pete?
I think the whole issue of, you know, kind of deflecting this again onto the victim, and this issue of proof and evidence, and then needing proof is also, we have to be careful that becomes a shield by which men can continue to perpetrate and hide behind that. Because as Anna says, usually these things occur behind closed doors. They're done privately. They're rarely ever observed by other people. When we had Steubenville, where we actually saw the sexual assault, of a young girl videotaped, and a whole community still stood by those boys, even where it was on videotape. So we have these, you know, so if you can't prove it beyond, I don't even know what would be more proof than the videotape and the recorded voices of these boys sexually assaulting this girl. I don't know what more we need. But even at that, you know, that creates then, how do we deal with the shield then that allows men to sexually assault? And unless you can prove it, they can continue to do that. And that's a serious issue. Because we get caught in that all the time, in this he said, she said. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to, well, what is it about the character of men? It goes right back to that. And I think that's the, you know, I'd love to have a dialogue on what's going on in the minds of men. where sexual assault for a portion of men is something that they feel entitled to be able to do.
Yeah, and before I get back to your phone calls, you know, I'm thinking of the people who didn't like the tone of this program, hearing some of Pete's comments there, mm-hmm. And thinking about evidence and standards. If someone walked into this building tomorrow and said, Evan Dawson sexually assaulted me, and it were not true, it would be a horrifying moment in my life. And I know that has happened to people, and it has potentially ruined lives. And we don't want that to be allowed to happen. So I don't think the message is, every person who ever says this, tell them, I believe you, and let's go get this person in jail immediately, fired, etc. I think the first response is to believe, simply because mm-hmm. the vast majority are not lying.
Correct.
We know that through scientific research, number one. And then number two, if they want to go forward with something, then they're, you know, you have a process that does play out, that does seek to gather whatever evidence you can and hold mm-hmm. certain people accountable. I don't think there's a perfect answer, Pete. You know, you're right. You point to Steubenville. That's an extreme case, and that's mind-blowing in many ways. So there's no perfect answer here. You don't want anyone's lives being ruined by false accusations, but the majority of the time, the vast majority, that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
Are we making sense there?
Yeah, and I think, you know, Anna pointed out earlier that the question that you ask somebody who has disclosed this to you is, I'm sorry that this has happened, and what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a spectrum of options available to somebody who's been sexually assaulted, whether it's just happened or happened, you know, decades ago. And empowering the victim to step into, I want to now deal with this and move forward from it, and recognize that in every case, we're not necessarily going to pursue a legal avenue of accountability, and it may just be about that person being believed enough that they can step into a process now of addressing it and healing from it, because it can really, this is the piece that's so frustrating when you work on the survivor side, is the amount of pain and distress that this experience can cause a person. It can derail your entire life. And the amount of courage that it takes to come forward and tell someone, whether it's law enforcement, which is incredibly difficult to do, or even a therapist in a private session, just to disclose, this has been that root cause thing that changed the trajectory of my life. So what these women are doing coming forward is really extraordinary, especially in such to be under that national spotlight. And I think looking at them with a lens of compassion is what's really important. And I also want to say that the Bill Cosby, you know, I'm as sad as anyone that he's fallen from the pedestal that we put him on for so long. He's done so many good things, but it doesn't negate now this horrible thing. And it really is a betrayal, almost on a national level. It's a betrayal for a lot of people.
All right, we've got a little bit more pushback coming from Twitter, and we're going to get back to the phones. Mary in Rochester, we're coming to you next. Let's get a short break in. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about lessons from the Bill Cosby story with our guests in studio. Allison O'Malley is the executive director of Resolve of Greater Rochester. Pete Navratil, the co-owner of Tree of Hope Counseling, co-founder of Stand Up Guys, which is a program of Resolve of Greater Rochester. Anna Potter is the director of programs and services at Bavona Child Advocacy Center. And Dee Krebs from the University of Rochester Emergency Department. And she is the director of the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program there. Your phone calls after this break. And let me also add, next hour is a bit of a departure in programming. President Obama speaks live starting at 1 p.m. about the Iran nuclear deal. A lot of people have been waiting to hear from the president on that. He will be taking questions as well. NPR will offer live coverage right off the top of the hour. That starts at 1 p.m.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Genesee Country Village, presenting a Civil War battle and encampment, including a portrayal of life as it was 150 years ago, with mounted cavalrymen, infantrymen, and firing cannons, Saturday and Sunday from 9:30 to 4. GCV.org. And the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
All right, welcome back to Connections, and let me start our next part of this conversation with some of Jenna's comments on Twitter. And Jenna is a regular listener of this program and someone who I certainly respect. And she says, which has a lower bar for guilt or innocence, a civil or criminal case? As an example, OJ was not guilty in the criminal case. He was guilty in the civil case. She says, my point is, have we seen or read all of the court documents or just the highlights? Even that does not prove this case for me. She's talking about the Associated Press publishing the excerpts from the deposition that Bill Cosby gave 10 years ago, in which he was asked, did you purchase Quaaludes for the purpose of giving them to women to have sex? And he said, yes. Jenna is saying, that is not a look at the entire documents. That is just look at the highlights. And she's saying that's not enough for her. So that's some more of the pushback that kind of what we're hearing. And I certainly want to air that out and let people, you know, have their say as we continue this discussion, because I'm certainly not here to stand on a mountaintop and cast about from on high. I brought in a panel that I certainly respect. But Anna Potter, what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, civil, the requirements for a civil case are much different than criminal. Criminal, it is, you know, you are looking for burdens of proof. And in civil cases, you're not. So, I mean, she's exactly right, you know, as far as looking at what we know. Unfortunately, these women, because of statute of limitations, won't even have that opportunity. So, you know, it kind of goes back to that stigma of them not feeling comfortable to come forward, and now they have. And, you know, they came through that one court case and the documents that came out of that, and that empowered them. So it's I guess one of my questions is always, why wouldn't we believe him? You know, is it because that he was an icon? Is it because, you know, what if this was Joe Blow on the street? Number one, it's not as public. We don't know Joe Blow on the street. Or what if this was one of the rappers that, you know, has a persona that they're throwing F-bombers in their songs, or, you know, they have tattoos all over? Would we believe them better, more?
Or they have videos where women are hanging off of them all the time.
Right.
You know?
The purity of Bill Cosby and what he wanted everyone to believe about him doesn't go hand in hand. So questioning what we have for evidence, and it comes right back down to the he said, she said. That's what we have. That's what we have. So, and if you have an investigator, you know, everyone, when you look at the disciplines and who handles sexual assault, I'm not an investigator. I'm not a district attorney. So I'm an advocate at heart. So when victims come forward, it's not my job to find the evidence. I don't think it's Jenna's job to find the evidence, but it is to look at the stigma, what we've been talking about, what Pete has alluded to. Victims come forward for reasons, you know, whatever they are, but it takes some courage. They were in a very vulnerable situation, and this situation, because of his celebrity-ness, made it even harder and more difficult for them to even come forward. Who is ever going to believe them?
Let me get to the phones. And on that question of what you do in terms of an investigation, and this is where I think we should try to dispel some misunderstandings. It's why Whoopi Goldberg on The View for months was defending Bill Cosby, because she said there should be evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I want evidence. And why isn't there an investigation? And Dan Abrams had to go on the show and explain to her the statute of limitation says we can't go back. And Whoopi Goldberg had to say, I didn't know that.
Right.
And so
she's recanted that a little bit.
She has. She's now backed off saying she wasn't aware of that. Keith is on the line. I'm sorry. This is John in Greece. And John wants to weigh in on that point as well. Go ahead, John.
Yes. Hi. From a legal standpoint, there may not be investigation because of statute of limitation. Prosecutors don't waste their time on stuff they can't prosecute. But from other standpoints, like civil situations, it occurs to me that if he had sex with 40 women, maybe there's a baby or two out there somewhere. I mean, you know, we know what causes babies, and he did it 40 times or so. So I would think there's a team out there maybe looking, or maybe some women who haven't come forward, and a paternity test. And also, if he admitted, and this is a little off my topic, but he's admitted to getting quaaludes to have sex with women. Who does that only once, and what normal person does that? And it's just sort of, you know, these people who say, well, he's not guilty until he's proven guilty. Yeah, but who does that? And if you, would you only do that once if you're inclined to do it at all? So those are my thoughts. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Thoughts from the panel?
Well, he had, what I read is he had 7 prescriptions for quaaludes. So it kind of goes to, I think, the caller's point about, you know, did he only do that once? And again, it's, you know, this isn't proof, but it's certainly, you know, why would you have access to so much of that drug if you were only going to do it once? But again, it's not proof, but I think it's just part of, you know, part of, well, what does that really mean about him?
Yeah, to now believe that Bill Cosby didn't do this, you now have to believe that 40 women have fabricated stories, perhaps, as Felicia Rashad said, in some sort of orchestrated fashion that we don't know about, that Bill Cosby had prescriptions for quaaludes for different reasons that we don't know about, that he said in a court deposition that he got the quaaludes for the purpose of getting women to have sex with him, and he was telling a false story in court. I mean, all of those things have to somehow align for him not to have sexually assaulted women. Yeah. And so you're right. I don't have a videotape of this. I don't have a direct evidence that some may say is direct enough. But it now is stacked so high that it is hard to see it in any other fashion.
It's also interesting that his wife is saying she was aware of his infidelity and that it was part of their arrangement that he was allowed to do that within the context of
right,
their marriage.
But sexual assault is not infidelity, right? I mean, that's different, isn't it?
It is different, but it is interesting that even she will align with the idea that he was sexually active with other women. Many wives would never readily come forward and acknowledge that that was going on in their marriage. And then you also have to think about his stage manager who came forward when he said, there's just too many women coming out, and I was complicit in this as well. So that's another magnitude of evidence, if you will.
Yeah. Mary in Rochester has been waiting to weigh in. Go ahead, Mary. Go ahead, Mary. Mary, are you there? Well, she has been waiting. I'm going to put you back on hold, Mary, and we'll come back to you in just a second. And let me grab Keith in Brighton now. Go ahead, Keith.
One of your panelists said something very, very important that seems to get overlooked, that Bill Cosby has been put on a pedestal and has fallen so far, something like that. But it's just the phrase being put on a pedestal. And that's what we do. We put these people on a pedestal. They don't climb up the pedestal because of their duties or because of what they've done. We put them on the pedestal, and then it's hard to believe that they're really not warranted. And the best example is the Steubenville football players. I'll guarantee it, the town put these football players up on a pedestal, and they were basically scumbags. And it happens constantly, whether it be entertainers, sports people, they get put on a pedestal, and then you find out they're just lowlights to begin with.
Thanks for the call, Keith. I don't know if anybody's going to disagree or what you think. I mean, that's essentially what you were saying about Steubenville, isn't it? That this was a town that didn't even want to believe it.
Didn't want to believe it. Those kids were important. The football coach went to the mat. I mean, there were public officials, like the mayor. I mean, there were a lot of people that just went to bat for these boys and making excuses. The age-old boys will be boys without thinking that boys should be, you know, be taught to be men of character, not of raping young girls.
Well, and Pete, here's a question that came in an email to the program from Ruth. And she says, so many statistics that we hear are about how vulnerable women are. And we are still having our focus steered toward the victims. Is there a statistic about how many men will become rapists? And if we focused on that stat, wouldn't the focus of our society be more on keeping men from becoming rapists in the first place, as opposed to focusing on what women can do to prevent being raped?
Absolutely. That is the heart and soul of why we even form Stand-Up Guys. If you think about it from a prevention model for a second, the Center for Disease Control, very simply, looks at prevention as a simple model. What's going on upriver that's making people downriver get sick? And so if you look at that from a primary prevention perspective, you got to like, well, what? Why are all these women being sexually assaulted? What's going on and who's doing that? That brings the conversation back to talking about what's going on in the minds of men. And then how do we begin to talk about this as a man issue, that sexual assault is perpetrated by men, it's a man's issue. If we look at it strictly from being a woman's issue, then it's always about what women need to do about keeping safe.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation
that's the best prevention, right?
Prevention we have is that, and this is another point, Bill Cosby offends me as a fellow male. Because what he does is he puts me back into the league of here's a man of high, Dr. Huxtable, of high quality, of high character, and he now becomes somebody that maybe you need to be afraid of because you really don't know what his motive is going to be. That means when I walk down the street as a male, women look at me as a potential rapist. And that happens to a lot of men who... that's the farthest thing from them, but how do you know that I'm not?
And Ruth is asking about stats. Are there stats about how many men end up committing sexual assault?
Dr. Lysik has some statistics about that and talks about a very small percentage of men. It goes back to the serial rapist. There's a small percentage of men who perpetrate a lot of rape. So, again, what happens with Bill Cosby kind of fits into that statistic where you have one rapist, multiple victims.
There's a lot of discussion around this going on with college campuses in the efforts to prevent sexual assault on college campuses, which is everywhere right now. And so Dr. Lysak's work, which comes from a 2002 study, cites that 6.2% of men on a campus are inclined to commit rape, and that typically in that study, he said they will rape at least 6 times during the years that they're on a college campus. So if their mindset is one that will allow them to contemplate raping another person, if they do it once, they will do it again. There's research that actually just came out yesterday in the Journal of American Medicine and the pediatric component specifically that challenges that rationale and says that really, it's more like 10.9% of young men on college campuses are inclined to commit rape. However, it is not generally repeated in the same way that Lysak studies. So what's concerning is that there's so little research on what makes a rapist, and what do we do about it? So we tend to only respond to a rape after it occurs and try to create some sort of intervention post-event. So there is more energy though going into that preventative angle. How do we do a better job assessing for likelihood of rape in a person's behavior and in their character? So there's movement in that direction.
Hmm. Well, as we start to wrap the program, let me go around the panel then, because the entire premise was what we can learn. And so Dee Krebs, who is the director of the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program, and a nurse practitioner at URMC's emergency department, what do you want to leave our audience with, and what of value can we take from this sad story?
Well, I just want victims to know that there's choices to make. There's medical choices, there's legal choices, and to always call either Rape Crisis or Restore, or go to your local emergency room if you have any questions, because we can definitely answer them and take care of it for you.
Anna Potter from Bavona.
I think that this story, what we take from it is that it really can be anybody, that while we don't want it to be someone that we love or no love and trust, or you know, in the media we don't want it to be, but the reality of it is that it really can be. So it's not just the scary man in the bushes. It's using our guts to really paying attention to the circumstances and our environment, and believing and that there are no boundaries with sexual assault.
Pete Navratil from Stand Up Guys.
I think the takeaway is that men have a role and responsibility learning from this and moving forward about how men have dialogues with each other about how we treat not only the women in our lives, but how we treat each other with dignity and respect, and understand that our choices can have some incredibly negative consequences on other people. But character matters. And I think that's a role that men can have, and that can be a conversation that can come out of this situation with Bill Cosby. Men have a role, and we can talk more about how we treat each other with dignity and respect.
And Allison O'Malley, the Executive Director of Resolve of Greater Rochester.
You know, I'm struck by some of the callers today, and that two of them were men, really allying themselves with the victims in both calls. And I just really want to acknowledge that, because it is important to recognize the voices of men who are courageous enough to stand up and speak out against domestic violence and sexual assault. So we need more of that. We need to facilitate more conversations with men about this issue, because, as Pete said earlier, you know, most men are good guys, and they really do care about the women in their lives and other women, and they just don't recognize the magnitude of the problem.
I wish it were a discussion we didn't have to have, but thanks for the work that all of you are doing in various ways for our community. I appreciate it, and I know our listeners do as well, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Short break, and we're coming back with the President's remarks live, just over 2 minutes away now. NPR will cover President Obama's comments on the Iran nuclear deal for the hour, the 1 o'clock hour, and the President will make those remarks in just a few minutes. I will talk to you on a Thursday on member-supported public radio.